This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back once again for your favorite virtual crate digging experience. This is Liner Note Leftovers. All the minutiae, history, and classic stories of your favorite rock and roll bands and songs without having to strain your knees bending down to dig through records at your local thrift shop. I'm glad you could be here once again. It's always great to see you. And this week we got a whole bunch of stories. We got the story of the knock on the head heard round the world, aka when Chris Novoselic of Nirvana managed to throw a bass at his own face. We're bringing back and bubbling up those memories of your favorite album, U2's Songs of Innocence, aka the one we all got for free through our iTunes. I know y'all love that one. How Kiss managed to save their record label and themselves with a very fateful live album. Finally determining what the heck is going on in Weezer's Buddy Holly. And last but not least, the story of Nathaniel Hornblower, the mysterious Swiss uncle of the Beastie Boys MCA, who's been credited with directing their music videos, taking the iconic Paul's Boutique photo, and also rushing the stage at the 94 VMAs. All that and more coming up on another Liner Note Leftovers. I'm not going to delay anymore. Let's drop that needle and get into another episode.
Question is now,
Zen Master,
how do we get it to as many people as possible? Because that's what our band is all about.
That fateful question, that damn fateful question, is why to this day you're still enraged that you have U2's Songs of Innocence in your iTunes library. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Any music lover remembers where they were on September 9, 2014. It was the day U2 decided to give out what has been called the worst gift of all time to over 500 million iTunes users. And that was Songs of Innocence. Now, full disclosure, I actually like U2 a lot and I don't hate that album. But even I got to admit, the rollout was such a fail. So here's what happened. On that day, Apple is announcing the iPhone 6, being touted as their latest invention, the best phone of all time, and always will be. But at the end, there's a surprise performance by U2, unveiling a new song from their not yet released Songs of Innocence. After the song gets played, Apple CEO Tim Cook hits the stage and somewhat dubiously asks,
Wasn't that the most incredible single you've ever heard? We would love a whole album of that.
And what ensues is what I can only call the most cringeworthy back and forth I think I've ever seen. I'm not gonna play the whole thing because it's like 5.5 minutes long, but basically it starts with Bono referring to Tim Cook as the
Zen Master of Hard and Software, Tim Cook.
And then asking the fateful question we heard at the beginning. So after doing this 6.5 minute, as Vulture calls it, cheesy vaudevillian bit, they unleash Songs of Innocence for free to half a billion people. Auto downloads right to their phone, right to their computers, right to their iPads. No action required on their behalf, but also, and this is where people started getting real freaked out, no consent. So a lot of people who didn't watch the Apple Spotlight event, didn't know what was happening, might have thought that their credit card information on iTunes was compromised. And when they finally realized they had this U2 album that they couldn't delete from their system, they were livid. Apple support lines were flooded with calls, angry people demanding the album be removed. Apple had to release a now defunct tool to manually get the album off of people's accounts. And to this day, there has to be new articles put out on how to delete this album because people are still trying to figure it out. To give you more insight onto how bad the backlash was, music writers for Salon called U2 the most hated band in America because of it. Patrick Carney of the Black Keys and Pink Floyd's Nick Mason said that this was a devaluement of music. The Washington Post called it rock and roll dystopian junk mail Slate said consent and interest are no longer a requisite for owning an album, only corporate prerogative. And now, even to this day, Bono admits that he got a little bit carried away when megalomania meets generosity meets self-promotion, which also meets the anxiety that the songs they apparently pored over might not have been heard. At the end of the day, he says they just wanted to deliver a pint of milk to people's front porches, and people complain that they were dairy-free. It's kind of a weird analogy, but you get what he's saying. And in all honesty, among U2 or any other band, a free downloads of an album mandated to your phone, it's no longer a thing. It's never been tried again for obvious reasons. And it's kind of sad, because how well received would this album have been if it didn't have such a piss poor rollout? Now let's take a little listen to a chunk of it and see what you think. From Songs of Innocence, and I know you've heard this one because it showed up automatically on your Apple CarPlay one time, this is The Miracle of Joey Ramone. You know, it's weird to think, in 1994, when you have the grunge era just winding down, metal really ramping up, gangster rap coming into its form, the rest of the chart being dominated by hot pop acts, the upcoming alt-rock revolution, that a bunch of nerds singing about a 50s rock icon would be a number two song on the charts. And I'm not just saying that to bag on Weezer, even though people know I like to bag on Weezer. I'm saying that directly from the ideas of Rivers Cuomo when it comes to the song Buddy Holly, which was released on September 7th, 1994. Yes, it shares the name with one of the first rock and roll stars to gain prominence in the 1950s, but that's about where the similarities end, with the exception of the possible coincidence that it was released on what would have been Buddy Holly's 58th birthday. So what is it actually about? What's going on in the Weezer song Buddy Holly? First off, it's not a romantic song. Rivers Cuomo has literally said it's about platonic friendship, and Buddy Holly wasn't even supposed to be invoked. It was actually supposed to be much more of a theater kid type song and invoke the name Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. If you don't know who that is, kids, ask your parents or your grandparents, because that one there's a throwback. But anyways, Rivers Cuomo chews on this one a little bit and realizes that, hey, that doesn't sound very good, so let me try ooh, I look just like Buddy Holly instead. And he finds that that works. So does the Mary Tyler Moore reference, which, as far as I could tell, the two didn't really know each other, Buddy Holly and Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, the Crickets did do the theme song to the Mary Tyler Moore show, but that's about the most close connection. But that's not the only weird lyrical concept going on here, I guess is the right word. The song starts out with something you would never associate with Mary Tyler Moore or Buddy Holly, the line, "What's with these homies dissing my girl?" Apparently, that's inspired by a real life incident. Rivers, when he was at Santa Monica College, was in the choir, along with a friend of his named Kyung Hee. Apparently, the Weezer guys were ripping on her one night. Rivers took exception to that. They were the homies dissing his girl. Yeah, it's about choir, as if that line could be any less hard. But that's what kicked off the rest of the song. And Rivers was initially apprehensive to give the song to the band or release it because A, he thought the song was super corny, and B, he didn't want it to create tension in the band. But strangely enough, when they agree to release this song, people don't think it's corny at all. In fact, it goes to number two on the Billboard Modern Rock chart. And just to add that extra bit of nerd spice on there, the popularity of the song skyrockets even more when it's included on the release CD of Microsoft Windows 95. The Happy Days inspired music video was a huge deal to watch on a computer at the time. Speaking of which, that Happy Days music video, that's a really great example of video splicing in the 90s. So great, in fact, that the 90s video referencing a 70s TV series set in the 50s breaks the mold of MTV, wins Best Breakthrough Video, Best Alternative Music Video, two Billboard Music Video Awards, and Alternative Modern Rock Clip of the Year. In fact, this video and the Beastie Boys' Sabotage were two videos that put a little-known director called Spike Jonze on the map. And he would later bring us such great things as Being John Malkovich and every single property in the Jackass series and a whole bunch of other great stuff too. But just listen to this song and think about how much the odds were stacked against it for it to break out in the 90s. Let's just say it was a little different than anything else that was going on. What's no one knows, ooh, ooh, and the- MTV VMAs have no shortage of stories of people bum rushing the stage. But long before Kanye West and talking about the best video of all time, or even Tim Comerford from Rage Against the Machine disrupting Limp Bizkit's set by climbing the scaffolding and accoutrements of the stage, there was Nathaniel Hornblower, who is the uncle, using air quotes there, of MCA of the Beastie Boys. He made his debut onto the world on September 8th, 1994, but he goes a little bit deeper in Beastie Boys lore than that. So check this out. The VMAs are going on September 8th, and a lot of people believe the Beastie Boys Sabotage music video is going to win a bunch of awards. It's interestingly shot, it's fast-paced, it does this whole retro cop caper story. It's a really great piece of work from that fledgling music video director we talked about, Spike Jones. It's a lot of fun, but strangely enough, they're losing out on every single award. Videos like Aerosmith's Crying is getting a bunch of awards. REM's Everybody Hurts. So as Michael Stipe is coming up to accept the award, a man with a big red beard, a feathered hat, and full lederhosen steals the microphone from him, and this is what ensues.
This is an outrage because Spike is the director that has just... I'm from Switzerland, okay? Let me just tell everyone that. And since I was a small boy, I had dreamed that Spike would win this. And now this has happened. And I just want to tell everyone that this is a farce, that I had all the ideas for Star Wars and everything.
Now, it ends fairly quickly after that, after Nathaniel Hornblower gets heavy-handed off stage by security, and a lot of the music critics would claim afterwards that REM was horrified by being interrupted. Meanwhile, if you watch the clip, it's very clear that Michael Stipe is laughing, and later he would say, oh, I just thought it was Bono. But what was really interesting is to watch all the music critics trash Nathaniel Hornblower like he was a new person. The Beastie Boys credited Nathaniel Hornblower with directing a lot of their videos, with the exception of Spike Jones, who he's running to the defense of in this clip. Nathaniel Hornblower is credited in the liner notes as being the man who took the iconic Paul's Boutique photo. And don't ask the Beastie Boys to ever divulge if Nathaniel Hornblower was actually just MCA. They fully say that he is, in fact, MCA's uncle, that they were all horrified when he rushed the stage, and they're fully committed to the fact that he's an old yodeler who invented snowboarding, built his own helicopter out of wood, plays a flugelhorn. He was the Swiss filmmaker who taught Spike Jones how to film and build his own cameras. He'd been doing them since the 50s. And he even came back on the scene to disrupt the system once again after the New York Times put out a bad review of the music video to Check It Out, sending reviewer Stephanie Zakarik a letter claiming that she owed him a goat for the bad review because a goat had died bringing him the newspaper in his Swedish hometown of Opensel. So he had to give the mailman one of his goats. Stephanie owes him a goat because he's a goat farmer when he's not playing the flugelhorn or directing Beastie Boys music videos or taking their iconic album photography or interrupting bands at the MTV VMAs. Forget about the Dos Equis guy. Nathaniel Hornblower might be the most interesting man in the world. He's not a man you want to cross, at least, so here's a bit of Sabotage. I want to start this off with a disclaimer. Do not try this at home, because if it ended poorly for the 6'7" bulk of a man that is Nirvana's Krist Novoselic, it's going to end even worse for you. But everybody's seen the, iconic clip from the September 9th, 1992 MTV VMAs of Krist throwing his bass up in the air and it coming down and slamming him in the head. But what looks like a silly little accident actually has a backstory and a fairly bombastic ending. So here's here's what happened. In 92, Nirvana's got one of the biggest music videos in the world with Smells Like Teen Spirit. They won two awards that night for Best New Artist and Best Alternative Video, but the evening is not plain sailing for the guys from Nirvana. By the time they'd got to the venue for the MTV Music Awards, there'd already been a massive tug of war between Nirvana and MTV because Nirvana wanted to play one of their newer tunes, the controversially named Rape Me. And because MTV wanted to keep it safe and keep it clean, or at least that's what they told the band, they keep prodding Nirvana to play Lithium instead. This whole back and forth between Nirvana, MTV, their people, it was draining. So they already got there in a bad mood and all out of sorts. So to help that along, Chris says the band started drinking warm beer from the concession table to kill time. Great thing to add on to some already existing anger. When Axl Rose shows up, and there was apparently a bit of a rivalry, a bit of a beef, which led to Courtney Love shouting, "Hey Axl, you're the godfather of our baby, Axl." Apparently this really pissed Axl Rose off for some reason. He walks over, demands that you keep the woman in line, which is not something you say to Nirvana. They would not take kindly to that. So there's a bit of a back and forth, and Axl Rose storms off. It gets worse when they get on stage and it's time for them to perform Lithium, which Nirvana did start off with a little bit of trolling.
"And now for all your lawn care needs, it's Nirvana!
Chris plugs into the bass rig and it's distortion, there's feedback, you can't hear what he's playing. So he's finally pissed off enough that it's like, okay, we're gonna destroy the set. So he's the one man to start this. He grabs his bass and just chucks it, swoop, straight up in the air. Now combine being a 6'7" man with a bit of rage behind your swing, that thing's gonna go up, according to Dave Grohl, 25 feet in the air. But the problem is when you're looking straight up on a soundstage 25 feet in the air, what's gonna hit you? The lights. The bass comes crashing down right into his head. Now Chris says he wasn't really all that hurt, but the shock of the instrument hitting him in the head and it being in front of 300 million people was enough to make him sort of stumble off stage. Kurt Cobain, if you watch the video too, even goes to kick him in the butt for screwing around and then stops when he realizes, oh man, Chris is actually really hurt, supposedly. So for the next 45 minutes, nobody knows where he is. They can't find him. Where do they actually find him, you might be asking? Well, he's drinking champagne with Brian May of Queen, even though he has a head injury and has just warded off the paramedics who were checking him out. A little bit of alcohol, that'll help him out. But hey, Brian May's a doctor. He was there in attendance if need be. It was astrophysics, but whatever. But the boys had a bit of a ruckus with Brian May. It was apparently a fun time all around. So I guess you could say it's not always bad when your instrument comes crashing down on your head from 25 feet up. You might meet your favorite rock star of all time. Actually, that probably wouldn't happen for most of us, so don't try this at home. Because if all of a sudden Jimi Hendrix is showing up, something might be more wrong. Oof, that was a little offside. Anyways, here's a bit of Lithium from the MTV VMAs. Sunday morning, it's every day. You know, it's really crazy to think how close Kiss was to fizzling out before they even took off. However, thanks to a lucky reversal of fortune and a whole lot of people who believed in them, they were able to turn the tide with the live album, Alive, released September 10th, 1975. Not only saving their band, but also their record label. This story starts in 1974. At the time, CEO of Casablanca Records, Kiss's record label, Neil Bogart, his life is just disintegrating. The label's been kicked off the teat of Warner Brothers. None of the bands on their roster are having a hit. And Bogart gets an idea. Why don't I release a double album of audio highlights from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson? To the surprise of no one, it flopped. Nobody wanted this. And in fact, people who got free promotional copies even sent theirs back. By the end of 74, Casablanca's got no money. To be making payroll for their staff, Neil Bogart has to cash in a line of credit at a Las Vegas casino. Now, at the time, Kiss, this flamboyant heavy metal outfit from New York City they'd signed, was also having a lot of trouble. They had a bit of a cult following in the US, but they just couldn't capture that live feeling in studio. I mean, really, how could you when you got a stage show that's so wild that Queen, Genesis, and Aerosmith all refuse to tour with you because you open for them, you kill, and they can't follow it up? And I won't say at the time Kiss was not trying. And by extension, Neil Bogart as well. Kiss had released 3 albums in studio, even though they'd flopped because they didn't capture that same energy. And Neil was out there hounding radio DJs, TV hosts, critics, music magazines to get into Kiss. Like, he was doing, I'm not even kidding here, literal magic tricks like the flash paper fireballs in these pitch meetings to try to get people interested. So by 1975, spring of 1975, it looks like they're gonna call it a day. Kiss might be over before it even starts. Till Bogart actually gets the idea, hey, let's put out a live album. And at the time, live albums were considered just contractual BS. Bands would put them out because they didn't have any new product and they needed to make the amount of albums that they obligated. Now, everybody was receptive towards the idea, but since the label A had no money, Bill Aucoin, the long-suffering manager of Kiss, had to put up $300,000 of his own money to send Kiss on tour. Somehow, also, they managed to rope in the legendary Eddie Kramer, producer for Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin, to oversee all the recordings. They packed 12,000 people into Detroit's Cobo Hall. They go all in to make this show what it was. Flamethrowers, bombs, cannons. Want to throw Peter Criss's drum kit 20 feet in the air? Hell yeah, let's do it. It got to the point where the tour was super successful, as Kiss tours had been, but the recordings were still kind of mediocre. The energy was there, but because of the frenzied show, some of the musicianship had been lost. So this is why I put live album in quotations, because a lot of these songs were re-recorded in studio. However, they keep just about everything else. Peter Criss's drum tracks, the stage banter, thousands of screaming fans. The rest of it is so live and fresh that you can almost smell the fake blood coming from Gene Simmons' mouth. The album Alive, which takes its name from Slade's Alive, which also inspired Kiss, is dropped on September 10th, 1975, and 5 days later, Kiss and Bill Aucoin repay all the favor and the good idea here by saying they're leaving Casablanca Records, which is so terrifying, Bogart mortgages his house to cut them a check for $2 million to retain them. And much like the bombs on the track, this album goes off like a bomb, peaks at number 9, stays on the charts for 110 weeks, becomes Kiss's first record to sell more than 1 million copies, and by the end of 1975, Kiss goes from a band that nobody wants opening for them to a band that has acts like Blue Oyster Cult and REO Speedwagon suddenly opening for them. And the rest is, how you say, history. But even if it's not really entirely live, I still think tracks like this, Rock and Roll All Night, still rock just as hard. And just like that, we're at the end of a record. That's it for this week's Liner Note Leftovers. But as always, I sure had a blast hanging with you in this virtual record shop. Hopefully you know a little bit more than you knew before, and maybe had a little bit of fun along the way, as I always say. And as always, you know, we'll be back next week with all new stories. So once again, I'll say thank you, and I love you for coming along once again, and I'll see you soon. And remember, if you have something you want to say about the podcast, feedback, a story maybe you want heard on Liner Note Leftovers, or maybe you just want to talk shop and chat about some music, you can always send me an email, danielmsoul@gmail.com, or of course, a message to my J-Job 1061 The Goat. If you can, don't forget to rate and review this podcast where you listen to podcasts. It helps us out a lot. getting us up in the charts and getting more people in the Liner Note Leftovers family. Once again, though, I appreciate you for coming along. Songs featured this week were U2's The Miracle of Joey Ramone, Weezer's Buddy Holly, The Beastie Boys' Sabotage, Nirvana's Lithium live at the 1994 VMAs, and Kiss's Rock and Roll All Night. With that, I'll bid you farewell, and don't forget, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to myloydminsternow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.